Elias Khoury, we count on novelists to tell us sooner or later what is going on. It's a huge privilege to meet the author of Gate of the Sun, the great novel of Palestinian experience. 2012, almost 2 years into this Arab upheaval. What's going on?
You know, first of all, my experience as a novelist is that writing a novel is a way for me to discover things, because and to discover things which I do not know. So I'm not the man you think he can lead you anywhere. I write because I don't know, not because I know. And I write in order to understand better. So writing is a personal experience for me to understand things. And now if it has implications on the readers, that's excellent. But the whole issue is to express my ignorance and to try to overcome my ignorance. This is why I write, not because I know. And now you're asking me about what we call the Arab revolutions. And, you know, for me, this was a great event. I think it's one of the most important events in our modern history. And the greatness of it comes from the fact that it was a surprise not only for the regimes, but a surprise for the opposition and a surprise for the intelligentsia, for the intellectuals also. We all were waiting something to happen, but we never knew how it will take place. And we never expected that a revolution will be so swift, like in Egypt and in Tunisia, to finish with dictators in very short moments. Nobody was expecting something to happen in Libya, which is, you know, this mad dictator. And everybody didn't dare to think that something of this sort could have happened in Syria. So it was a big surprise, and it was a way that history revealed to us our ignorance first, and revealed to us on the second level that we need to learn all the time. We need to go back to the school of history and to learn. And once I was asked by a journalist in Beirut if I feel that I am a father figure of these revolutions, because I've written a lot against dictatorships, I said, on the contrary, I feel I am the son of these kids. I am no more a father, I am a son. And if you are a wise father, you must know when the time comes to behave like a son to your son. Otherwise, you'll lose any real contact with reality. So I am actually, I'm actually learning from these kids who made this revolution. And I feel that these revolutions in the Arab world are mainly a cultural event, not a political event. And what I mean by that, I mean that it was an explosion. Societies couldn't anymore bear this type of madness and irrationality and brutality, and societies expressed themselves directly without any medium, without even the medium of the intellectuals. Normally, we use intellectual work in order to build a strategy, in order to build an idea. Here, there was nothing of the sort. There was something coming from the depths of the society, and it was totally spontaneous. And even for those who participated in it, they were totally astonished. They were totally taken by surprise, because nobody expected. Even the heroes of this event did not expect what was coming out. This is why, and of course, taking into consideration the political emptiness that these dictatorships had created in the Arab world, it was very difficult to translate this socio-cultural event into a political structure. And this is why, if you are now in Cairo and you can feel it, This is why, for example, the only power to take, the only political power to emerge was the Muslim Brotherhood, because the Muslim Brotherhood was actually part of the ancient regime, even if it was the opposition of the ancient regime. And the Muslim Brotherhood took power because there was nobody else, not because people wanted the Muslim Brotherhood. And now you feel even the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or the Nahda in Tunisia, they are not prepared to govern. And we are still in deep vibrations, social and political and cultural vibrations, which I think will take a long moment in order to, for us, for the Arab societies, to recreate political apparatus, for the people to come back to politics, because people were totally separated from politics. Mm-hmm. Politics was only the work of a small elite related to the military and to the mafias in the surroundings of the military. So it will need time in order to translate these revolutions into political revolutions. And this is a moment, I think, is a very precious moment, is a very rich moment. Mm. And on the contrary of many, I'm not pessimistic at all, because in some intellectual circles who did not expect first these revolutions, then did not understand how these revolutions took place, and now they are so much irritated by the fact that the Islamists took power. They are very pessimistic. I am not pessimistic at all. I am very optimistic. I think that we are in a process, and we have to participate in this process, and we have to play a major role in rebuilding intellectually the concept of democracy. Because what's democracy, by the way? I mean, democracy is not elections. This is, of course, elections is an essential part of democracy, but democracy is a whole social structure. And what is democracy in societies which are very poor, where you don't have a middle class, like if you take the situation of Egypt, because it can lead to chaos and it can lead to civil war. So we have to reinvent the idea of democracy in a new way, and put together the idea of democracy and the idea of social justice together, and think about the region as a region. You know, the region is open region, is an empty region. Politically, since Egypt went away from the Arab world after the Camp David treaty, the region is without leadership at all. So it's a vacuum where the Iranians are trying to fill the vacuum, the Turks are trying to fill the vacuum, the Israelis are taking big advantage of it. So we have to re-establish this idea of the security of the region. And this is all a very long, interesting, but difficult task. The Arab intellectuals, the Arab politicians, the new generation of militants must fulfill.
I love this idea that it's a cultural event, and it's one we hear so little about compared to the day-to-day politics. Khaled Fahmy, the historian, was telling us last night that not only that it's a cultural happening, he said between these two blocks in Egypt of the deep state, the military power, and the populist religious movement, he said the third way will prevail because of the poetry of the third way. That's what I'm still trying to grasp. What is the poetry of this cultural moment?
Well, this is very beautiful. Very beautiful. Poetics, not poetry. It must be like that. It must be because of the poetics of the moment, not the poetry of the moment. But anyway, I think that what we call the deep state in Egypt, that is the military, I think the military can, after five decades of direct control of the country and of failures, you know, the military took their legitimacy when they made their coup d'état revolution in 1952. after the defeat of the Nakba, of the Palestinian Nakba of 48, that they want to build an army. This was their major point.
And the Nasser time.
Yeah, and then we discovered in 67 that they didn't build an army, and the army collapsed in 3 hours actually, The other legitimacy was social justice, which totally collapsed with the Sadat and then Mubarak regimes, and then what we have a mafia type system. So I don't think that the military can come back to power. On the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic, the popular Islamic feeling. First of all, we are Muslims. I'm not, but I mean, the majority of our population is Muslim, and Islam is part of our culture, which is normal. I mean, and this phobia, this European and American phobia of Islam, is a little bit exaggerated, because if you just see the flags of the European countries, you see the cross all over. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are also Christians, and so we can be Muslims, but the political Islam, I think culturally, and here it's an essential thing. Culturally, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood was created 80 years ago.
80.
Yes. So it's a long period. And through 80 years, they did not produce any writer. There is no one novelist, no one poet, no one philosopher. They did not produce culture. And if you don't produce culture, you cannot control a country. Countries are controlled, you know, I mean... What Gramsci calls hegemony.
Yes.
To create a real hegemony, you need culture, and the Islamic movement, all this Islamic tendency, which I respect. I'm not against Islam. I'm not against the belief of the people, and I respect what my countrymen believe in. Although I'm outside this whole. Categories of believers and so on, but the problem of political Islam is that political Islam was and is and will be unable to produce culture, and this means that of course you can be afraid that they are in power now, but seriously, I'm not afraid.
Why is the Brotherhood incapable of culture?
No, it's not only the Brotherhood, also Hezbollah. I mean, the whole Islamic political movement was unable to produce culture. Now they are very active in mass media, but this is not culture. I mean, they have a television, which is okay, but I think this is very deep, and it will reveal a point which nobody, especially in the West, thought of it, because the dominant idea about Islam and the Arab world and so on, is based upon all this Orientalist work, which saw the Arab culture as an Islamic culture and even the Arabic language as a sacred language, because it was the language of the Quran, where the Quran was written by God revealed the Quran to the Prophet. Now, actually, if you know. Profoundly the classical Arabic literature, you will find one thing which is unbelievable, and I think it is a very special thing in Arabic literature if you compare it to all European literature, for example. That is, Arabic literature was all through a secular literature from the beginning, and which put all the Islamic religious thought outside literature, and I don't think they can come back. They can enter it now after 2,000 years. I mean, I think it's too late.
So, give us your own extension on Khalid Fahmy's idea that it's the poetry in the situation that will save us.
I really don't know what Khalid meant, but I think maybe he meant the poetics, that is the revolution as poetry. But what I think is really that. Culture will save us. Not save us. I mean, culture, the cultural production will continue to be secular, will continue to be related to the daily life. which means that it's not sacred, and so it will it the whole this whole process of going back to the past, which is the main idea of all the Islamists, is to go back to the past, because all the history is corrupt, and we have to go back to the times of the Prophet and so on and so forth. Cannot work because I think the daily life is more powerful than texts. I think life is more powerful than sacred texts, and if there is something sacred, it's life itself, not the text about life. So in this sense, I think that life will win in the last analysis, but this doesn't mean that we have to repeat the faults of the past. The faults of the past was from the secular intellectuals to refuse to recognize that Islam is here, which was stupid and which is meaningless. On the contrary, I think that the works of... There is an Egyptian thinker, whom I think is a great thinker, whose name is Nasser Hamid Abu Zayd, who was a Muslim, but irrational Muslim. And he ended by going to exile because of his ways of interpreting Islam and interpreting Quran in a rational way. I think this kind of thinkers, this kind of thought must flourish to meet us in the middle of the road in order to create a society where both, where all faiths can live together, and where faith will be an individual choice and religion will be an individual choice, and we have to solve real problems. I mean, you know, my criticism of the Egyptian elections and of the Tunisian election was that the liberals and the seculars and the leftists and so on entered the trap of the politics of identity. And I think politics is not identity. I mean, first of all, identity is a stupid, is a stupid and banal and one level way of seeing things, because there is no one who has one identity. Each individual have different identities in him. But nonetheless, instead of going to debate about the politics of identity, we have to debate about real politics, about the politics of social politics, about education, about agriculture, about industry. This is the real debate, and I think the fault that the seculars, because they don't have a political apparatus, the trap which the seculars went in through in the elections must not be repeated. The issue is not about our identity. The issue is about our life. Politics is to solve problems of life. Yeah. It's not to solve the problems of identity, because the problems of identity, God will solve them. We have to leave them to God.
Speak of the Arab Revolution as an emotional, as a psychological marker, both as a cultural event, but also as something breaking through, an amazing simultaneity there in Tahrir Square. What was happening to the Arab soul, the Arab heart, to Arab hearts, maybe?
You know, and I think there are many elements. One of them is that we crossed the bridge of fear. Go back to the dialectics of the slave and the master of Hegel, of the German philosopher. I mean, you are a slave. There is a master because you are a slave, and he will continue to be a master because you accept to be a slave. Once you don't accept to be a slave, khalas, he's no more a master. But these regimes create an era of terror, which terrorized everybody, and which made everybody feel that he is incapable, and that the people itself, the people as an entity, is the problem. This is why, for example, if you analyze the Mubarak regime, I analyze it at least on the cultural level, how he used to play this game with intellectuals. I mean that I'm protecting you against the Islamists, whereas he was giving the Islamists all the cultural space. I mean, so it was a very, very complicated contradiction he was playing in order to create fear in society, that society is afraid from itself. So once there were a bunch of kids who decided not to be afraid, I think everything collapsed. Now this, you know, I feel when I come to Cairo, people are still poor, they are even more poor. The economic problems are still there, even they are more complicated. But you feel freedom. You feel people, they are at ease with their bodies. Yeah. Even the muhajabat, the women who cover, they are so sexy. I mean, because, you know, here the veil is not an Islamic sign. It's a mode. It's a social sign. That is, not every woman who has a veil is an Islamist. On the contrary, so you feel the body language totally changed, and you feel people feeling their power, which means that no one can repeat dictatorship. So this is a very profound change. Now, how to create from this change a real victory of the revolution? It's still a long way, and you know it's not evident. And it's not necessary that revolutions will win. You know, in history, in the world history, most of the revolutions failed, by the way. We only speak about the revolutions that won. But this process itself, I think, is liberating our souls, liberating our bodies, and liberating our imagination. And I think now it is the big challenge for the Arab societies to prove that their reconciliation with history, because I think these revolutions reconciliated the Arabs with history. The Arab people was totally kicked from history by these dictators and by the failures and by the defeats, the national defeats, I mean, with Israel and so on. These revolutions made a reconciliation between us and history. Now we have to prove that we deserve this reconciliation. And we can build upon it. So it's still a long way to go.
What is the Palestinian dimension of this revolution? They're in the worst trouble in a certain way in the Arab world, and we hear the least about them.
You know, there are many levels to this. One of them, I think, is that in the perspective, I mean, Palestine needs these revolutions because the way the Palestinians are trapped in the after the Oslo agreements and are trapped in the international community and are trapped facing the Israelis alone will lead nowhere, because the Palestinians alone cannot face the Israelis. And unfortunately, the peace process did not work. And it did not work because, and you know, it's amazing, because what happened in the Oslo agreements was a surrender. My reading of the Oslo Agreement, it was a surrender by the PLO, total surrender by the PLO. And when your enemy refuses your surrender, this is very dangerous, because it means something very, very deep and very dangerous. Because if you surrender, if the Japanese surrendered in the Second World War, if the Americans refused the surrender, it means what? It means they will continue bombing. they will destroy the whole Chinese population. I think the Palestinian people is faced now, after their surrender was refused, by the possibility that the Nakba, that the ethnic cleansing, which began in 1948, will continue, and they cannot face it alone, without the Arab world. So in the If you analyze deeply the Arab revolutions, I think it will be for the benefit of Palestine. But for the moment, in order to be the Arab revolutions have to rebuild their countries. So it's a very tough time. It will be a very tough time for the Palestinians. I think that the situation in Palestine cannot continue the way it is. And I think that the Palestinians, after all these failures, I will not be surprised if there will be a third intifada in Palestine.
And what of Lebanon, where you live, yes, so close to the fire in Syria? I mean, what is the story of the Arab Revolution where you live?
You know, Lebanon is a very special country, which after, you know, in Lebanon there was a big event which nobody tries to analyze, which actually happened in 1976, when our Syrian brothers, the army of Syria, occupied Lebanon. Actually, when the Syrians occupied Lebanon, they came and destroyed the Lebanese National Movement, which was a secular leftist movement and which was on the edge of taking power in the country and of winning the civil war against the right-wingy fascist Falangist party and its allies. Now, after that defeat, the way our Syrian brothers manipulated the country, they reproduced in a very bad way equilibrium and fight between the different Lebanese sects. So anything from that time on, even the invasion of 1982, the Israeli invasion of 1982, will translate itself in Lebanon in the terms of the sectarian strife between different religious groups. They are translated the Syrian revolution in sectarian terms. So if you are a Shiite, you must be with the Assad family. If you are a Sunni, you must be against Assad with the revolution. Mm-hmm. And my reading of the horizon of the Arab revolutions is that when the Syrian regime will be toppled, and hopefully, let's hope that it will come soon, because it's been a lot of blood, a lot of death, a lot of destruction. I think these whole terms of the Lebanese politics will change, because these terms will become meaningless. That is, these political confessional groups to be related to a power from outside in order to empower themselves or to become more powerful and so on will become totally meaningless. Mm. And at that moment, I think there will be a chance, even if it's a small chance, for people like us to play a bigger role.
Elias Khoury, we meet you by chance almost in Cairo, but we want to follow you back to Beirut at the start of December. And I'm hoping very much that you will introduce us in Lebanon to the young spirits who probably much better than the politicians and the pundits and even the journalists may have a sense of what's happening and what's coming. It's a great pleasure and an honor to hear you here. And I thank you very, very much for your marvelous work, especially Gate of the Sun, and for this conversation.
Thank you very much. And I'll be more than happy to welcome you in Beirut.
Thank you so much.